Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. And with me in the studio this week is Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome, Jeremy.
Hi, great to be here.
Megan Henry, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Hi, Megan.
Hello.
And Shane Stegmiller, a reporter for Hannah News Service. Hi, Shane.
Good morning. Happy Cinco de Mayo.
Oh, it is Cinco de Mayo. No margaritas for us. It's too early. And we're working. Very serious journalists here. So tomorrow is a primary election. And if you are listening right now, chances are you have not voted yet. The early voting numbers have been very low around Franklin County and around the state. But there are things to vote on. Columbus has a city council seat and several school board seats. And six Central Ohio school districts, some libraries, and some municipalities have levy requests on the ballot. Plus, there is a statewide issue, issue two. It's a billion-dollar measure to repair roads, bridges, and other infrastructure that voters have supported for decades. Jeremy, can you give us a brief explainer on issue two?
Sure. It's a proposed constitutional amendment. It would actually issue $2.5 billion in new state infrastructure bonds. This is a program that's been around for about 40 years, and it's the fourth time voters have had to vote on it. And these bonds, when they're sold, the money is offered via grants and interest-free loans to local governments who can use it to build a range of there's like a list of what they can use it for. So like roads, bridges, wastewater treatment facilities, things like that. And in the past, it's been pretty non-controversial. This time, it's also at least gotten broad bipartisan support. But voter turnout is going to be so low for this election that there's questions about whether it will pass this time. Not so much because people are saying, oh, I know what this is and I don't like it, but there's confusion. There's anecdotal reports that people are confusing this with the Cleveland Brown Stadium bonds issue, which it's completely unrelated to. And people, they're in this general economic climate, people might be leery of new spending measures.
And is the confusion that you mentioned just because both issues have the word bond involved? Is that?
Basically, yes.
Okay.
It boils down to that.
So if someone actually goes into the voting booth and reads it, the word Browns, Cleveland is not going to be in there anywhere.
Yeah. And again, if you look at the language of the proposed constitutional amendment, it's pretty clear what it's limited to. So I guess technically, like if you could use the money to build a new sewer system for the Brown Stadium, there's been, to be very clear, no sign that that's going to happen.
Right.
But there's a very specific list of what you can use it for, and new NFL stadiums is not on that list.
Now, this issue has passed before, and issues like this where it's infrastructure can always seem to pass, right? So are people worried about it? What happens if it doesn't pass?
If it doesn't pass, it's going to end in 2026, and local officials say, the benefits of this, according to proponents, is that these are for smaller municipalities like villages and smaller cities. This allows them to build projects they otherwise couldn't afford. And then for larger cities, it allows them to build projects on a faster timeline and do more than what they would. Because there's only a limited number of ways that the state gives money to cities for infrastructure projects. And this is one of the main ways they do it. So that would be the result if this doesn't pass.
But you're saying if people do vote no, it's most likely that, well, not necessarily that they're confusing with Cleveland Browns, but it's more likely that they just don't want money being spent on anything, do you think? Would that be a reason? Why would we vote no?
That would be in the main, again, it would, the main reason, just in general, when people see things on the ballot they don't understand, they tend to vote no. Like,
yeah.
Oh, what is this? I don't know. I'm going to vote no. I don't want to be behind something I don't understand.
Yeah.
And there's some of that. But on the other hand, this is a fairly straightforward proposal of what this is. This doesn't get too convoluted and too complex. It's, hey, money for local projects.
Right. Okay. And Shane, you wrote about the low voter turnout for early in-person voting. I mean, how low is it? Pretty low.
It's pretty low. We're about 1 or 2% right now. I checked the numbers this morning. about 163,000 people have cast early ballots. For the whole state. And that's out of about 8 million registered voters. So it's pretty low. And I talked to the Secretary of State, Frank LaRose, last week, and he said he confirmed that it's a low turnout. And he said it tends to happen an odd number of years. He points to all the even number of years and how we've been breaking records and for in-person voting and early voting in 2020 and 2022 and 2024. He said the federal elections bring people out, but the odd number of years, which this would be one of them, people just don't turn out to vote as much.
And Shane, you also wrote about some counties are going to be using paper poll pads, which means those big books of paper, instead of iPads for this primary. What did Secretary of State Frank LaRose say was the reason that some counties, not all, but some counties are going back to paper?
So this came out back in March. He announced this and issued a directive. And what happened is what we're talking about are basically iPads, tablet style.
When you check in,
they go through, find your name real quick. You check in that way. It happens pretty quick. Perry County got new ones, and they went to go test them out. And they're not given a lot of details, but according to the Secretary of State, they plugged them in, and it was, quote, exhibiting odd behavior that was not consistent with our security policies. Now, they never got used during an actual election. They were just testing them out. So what he did was he ordered any county that uses this style of electronic poll book to switch to paper poll books for this election, just so they don't have any issues while they investigate. And they're not giving a lot of details on what happened or where it is, because it is an ongoing investigation. But he said that he kind of compared it to he made an analogy to the issues going on in the airline industries, is when a door falls off of a plane, the FAA grounds all of that type of plane until they can figure out what's going on. And he said, and that's kind of what he did in this case, you know. And he kind of compared the using the paper ballot or the paper books, poll books, as kind of like going out and renting a car and driving that way. He's like, you know, that we do have a backup. You know,
He went deep with this analogy.
He did
okay.
Go deep with this analogy.
So this impacts 49 of the 49 counties, not all 88. So my
Correct.
Understanding is that for Franklin County, where we're sitting right now, they will have iPads tomorrow. I think
that's my understanding too.
Okay. So, but out there, 49 counties will have the paper poll pads, but it slows down things a little bit flipping through, but it shouldn't. I mean, it's going to be a low turnout election, so there shouldn't really be a line.
And that's what he said, is it shouldn't take as long because it's going to be a low turnout election. Now, hopefully they can get this all solved by the November election, but that might not be a high turnout election either. I'm assuming they'll move pretty quickly to resolve any issues. And
yeah, Megan Henry, let's bring you in here. What do you make of the low voter turnout and this off-year election that has one statewide issue and then like littler issues?
Yeah, it's not very surprising. I think I've personally seen a lot more about the local races in the Columbus area than I have about issue two. Like, there are no ads on TV for issue two. I've received a handful of mailers for candidates in the local elections, but I really haven't received any thing in the mail, I believe, for issue two. So I just think there's a lot less, as Jeremy was saying, just general lack of knowledge around this.
Now, next hour, we're going to be talking to the three candidates for Columbus City Council District 7, but the way Columbus districts work is you don't have to live in District 7. Everyone in the whole city of Columbus can vote in this primary. So stay with us for that for next hour at 11 o'clock. But I will say that tomorrow is the election. Polls are open tomorrow. That's Tuesday, May 6th, from 6:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. And that statewide issue, too, will be on the ballot. And then you can check your local board of elections. I mean, you can look and see what's on your ballot. If you live in Columbus, you'll have that city council race and Columbus school board. I don't know. There's a few other school districts. There's a few other municipality levies, libraries. Does anyone know any more?
I mean, there's some areas of the state that don't have anything on the ballot except for issue two, to the point that state lawmakers had to appropriate $15 million to reimburse elections officials for having an election at all.
Oh, so they wouldn't have to have the election if it weren't.
Yeah, because there's nothing on the ballot.
I see.
So it's kind of a patchwork of different things on the ballot.
Yeah, you mentioned libraries. There's about 13 library systems across 12 counties that have issues on the ballot.
Okay. This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich, and with me this week is Megan Henry from the Ohio Capital Journal, Shane Stegmiller from Hannah News Service, and Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com. So since it was first mentioned, I'm going to move on to the Brown Stadium now. Since it was first mentioned that the Haslams wanted the state to help fund a new dome stadium for the Cleveland Browns, not a week goes by without this issue coming up in the news. Most recently, the state's budget director weighed in on the $600 million bond proposal and called it, quote, risky. The Ohio budget and management director, Kimberly Murnix, wrote a memo that due to other capital projects waiting for funding, the state does not have the capacity to accommodate $600 million in bonds for a single sports facility. Jeremy, I just summarized an 8-page memo in 2 sentences. How'd I do?
Pretty good. There were actually 2 memos released last week, and these are the first state analyses, basically the first outside analyses to be publicly released about a Brown stadium. Up until now, we've just kind of had the Browns' own numbers and projections to look at, and we haven't even had all their full numbers, just sort of their headline assurances that this would be financially doable. So both the Murnix memo that you talk about, the OBM memo, and one from the Legislative Budget Office, from the Legislative Service Commission, they poke holes, a lot of holes into the Brown Stadium numbers, and they just question that they question the idea about that lawmakers are looking at now about issuing $600 million in state bonds. There's that word again, pay for a new Brown Stadium, which overall is going to be $2.4 billion, half of which would be paid by the team, a quarter by the state, and then a quarter, according to what the Browns want at least, by Cuyahoga County. So the argument from the Browns is, hey, we're going to raise enough tax revenue, sales tax, income tax, commercial activity tax from the stadium site itself and the surrounding development, that'll pay off the bonds. And these memos say, that might not happen. They said the jobs numbers that would be created would be, quote, overblown. That's according to Kim Murnix's memo. And it basically questions a lot of what the Browns are saying is overly rosy. A lawmaker's reaction to this so far has not been, whoa, we need to take a step back. If you ask legislative leaders like we did, they basically said, well, now there's 2 sides. We don't know who to believe, so we're going to look into it now and see who's right, we don't regret anything, and we're going to take a look.
Yeah, the items she listed in her memo that she says that are waiting for funding, the examples she gave were Dayton's Mental Health Hospital, the Department of Youth and Youth Services Facilities, prisons, state parks, H2 Ohio program. From an outside perspective, those all seem like important projects. Are they more important than a sports stadium? What would you say, Megan?
That is the question. It's interesting because with the stadium, with the Browns stadium, that is, there's other professional sports teams in Ohio, and so the Bengals are now also requesting money, and so I think it's just kind of. I think this could set a precedent potentially, depending on how this shakes out, for how other sports teams are trying to get money for new stadiums or improvements to their stadiums.
Mm. Yeah, go ahead, Jeremy.
The striking thing to me about this is that Kim Murnix works for Governor Mike DeWine. Mm-hmm. And this was a strong pushback against the Browns plan by the DeWine administration, and the governor's proposed an alternative plan. He wants to double the state tax on sports betting companies to create a permanent source of funding for stadium funding, both the Browns, the Bengals, everyone going forward. And so this is also a political memo making the case by the governor that this is a better idea to do that plan than to issue bonds one time for the Browns.
Now, Senate President Rob McCauley said that he was trying to work out what numbers to believe, like you mentioned. He said the Browns did not just put forward their economic numbers out of nowhere. And then also House Speaker Matt Huffman said that the memo from the budget director, his understanding was that it was written in March, but the House didn't see it before they passed their version of the plan. So do we know why the governor waited to release the memo?
We don't. I'd been waiting for weeks to get it. I filed a public records request. The reason given to me is that they were trying to redact. They were negotiating with Brown's representatives to redact information, although the memo I got didn't have any redactions in it. So I'm not exactly sure why they waited several weeks to do it. And as you said, in the meantime, the House passed that $600 million bond plan.
Yeah. And Shane, I have to think that if the Senate does pass any version of this that's not what the governor agrees with, he might line item veto it.
And he has that power, and I don't see why he wouldn't, because he's made it clear that he does not think that the bonding for the Browns is the right way to go. He's been very adamant. Hmm. And he usually doesn't, you know, speak out publicly when they're going through the budget process on a lot of these things. But this is something that he has taken a strong stance on.
Well, yeah. Has he actually spoken on it, or has he kind of spoken via the memo?
I don't know if he's spoken directly in the memo. He's had a couple of meeting appearances, which I haven't been there to, but been there for. But he, in general, he's made it very clear. He basically said, you know, if we don't do this, meaning his plan, we're crazy. So he's made it very clear where he stands on the issue.
And he's pretty much echoed a lot of what Megan said, which is everybody, every professional sports team in Ohio is going to come to us with their hand out. And they already are.
Yeah. When the last thing I'll ask about this is kind of just related to the current stadium. So Cuyahoga County executives are now asking for money to renovate the current Lakefront Stadium. What is that all about? What do they want to do?
It's basically in response to, as Megan said, the Bengals are asking for $350 million to renovate Paycor Stadium. And so Chris Ronayne, the Cuyahoga County executive, said, okay, well, great. Well, hey, we're going to put our own budget ask out there. And we're going to ask for $350 million to renovate Huntington Bank Field in downtown Cleveland. Now, just because you ask for something doesn't mean you're going to get it. And legislative leaders said, well, we haven't seen this and we'll take a look at it. I would be very surprised if it passed in its current form. I mean, because the whole legislative debate about a Brown stadium has not been, should we give the Browns $600 million? It's been around, how do we give the Browns $600 million? And that's what this debate is focused on, not whether we should do it, but how do we do it?
So are we going to be seeing the Senate talking about this in the this week, maybe next week?
Yeah, in the coming weeks as they put together, because this is part of the state's enormous 5,000-page state budget plan. And where there's hundreds of provisions on different things. And there's been talk about us doing some sort of hybrid plan where you raise taxes on sports gaming companies. Keep in mind, this is not on sports betting. So like if you and I place a bet on sports, we're not, the tax would not be paid by us directly. It would be on these companies' gross profits. And so a hybrid plan would be to, okay, we'll raise the tax on those profits and then use that revenue to issue bonds. But we'll see what they come up with.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll talk about it next week because we talk about it every week. So the Brown Stadium saga continues. Coming up on the Reporter Roundtable, we're going to talk about a sweeping energy bill that finally passed both the House and Senate. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. With me this week is Megan Henry, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hanna News Service, and Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com. So Ohio lawmakers passed a sweeping energy bill. It increases oversight over what electric utilities charge customers. It repeals coal and solar subsidies dating back to the House Bill 6 scandal. And it will encourage the construction of more power plants. Jeremy, this bill was a long time in coming, especially the parts of it related to House Bill 6. That dates back to 2019. Can you tell us more about this bill?
Sure. So this bill, which is now headed to Governor Mike DeWine, it would really do three things. One is it would encourage the construction of new power plants, specifically natural gas power plants in Ohio, via tax incentives and accelerating the approval process. So there's two things kind of going on in the state. One is there's more natural gas development going on. So the idea is, well, we have this natural gas from Ohio. Let's use it to generate electricity. And at the same time, there are a lot of data center projects popping up, especially in central Ohio, mm-hmm. and those suck a lot of power to the point I saw one statistic that we're going to use more power than Manhattan by 2030 than New York City, just mm-hmm. because these data centers use a lot of power. So, well, the argument is, okay, well, we have this natural gas over here, and we have this increased demand over here. Well, let's accelerate the process and offer property tax incentives to help move that along. So that's one. Second, as you said, it would repeal the subsidies for solar and these two coal-fired power plants, one in Indiana, one in southern Ohio, that got subsidies under the scandal-ridden House Bill 6, which it's now been established was passed with the with $60 million in bribes from First Energy, the Akron-based utility. The third thing, it's interesting, too, actually. This bill actually does a lot to rebuff electric utilities in Ohio, not just First Energy, but around the state in a way that's, at least to me, mildly surprising, given that utilities have been just so politically powerful in Ohio for decades, especially around the state house. For example, it forces utilities to undergo a rate review every year. So state regulators will now, every 3 years, have to do a across-the-board review of how much utilities charge their customers, what their fees are. And up until now, there's been an increasing trend toward utilities getting these one-off charges passed, mm-hmm. and they don't show up in on your and my utility bill, but if you go online, you can see them. And now they're saying, no, well, you can't do that. You can't pass these riders anymore. It has to be via this across-the-board regulatory review every 3 years. So that's
Is that review through the PUCO?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. The Public Utilities Commission of Ohio.
Yeah.
And this came up actually in the House Bill 6 scandal, because among the things that these former First Energy executives are now charged with, and they've said they're not guilty, but they're charged with bribing the former chair of the PUCO, the late Sam Randazzo. They said that they bribed him, among other things, to postpone First Energy's rate review case because it would not work out well for them. They would have to say, you guys have to scale back these charges. And because once they pass these charges for things like infrastructure and stuff like that, they don't have to, that or energy efficiency, they don't have to pass the savings then on to customers. They can just pocket the profits from this. And so that's something that, at least to me, was mildly surprising that lawmakers pass this.
And Shane, this bill has been a long time in coming, as I said, and it repeals things related to House Bill 6 that date back to 2019. What do you make of this finally getting into a bill and getting passed?
This was the last thing. The repeal of the subsidies for the coal-fired plants was the last major thing from House Bill 6 that was still remaining, much to the chagrin of a lot of the opponents to that bill. The General Assembly passed legislation last General Assembly passed legislation that repealed a lot of the other things from House Bill 6. This gets rid of some of the final pieces of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess the average person will just ask, will this lower my gas or electric bill? Like, what does the average Ohioan, what will they notice because lawmakers finally passed this energy bill?
It varies because for at least coal plants, for example, we know over the course of between 2016 and 2024, these Ohio ratepayers paid a total of $679 million to subsidize these plants. For solar, it was a little different because they collected $62 million, but they only spent $8.5 million of that, so it gets a little more complicated. But it varies because it depends how profitable these coal plants are, you know, over the course of the years. Like there was one year that actually ratepayers got some money back because coal was pretty profitable. And so it varies exactly what it does. But in the aggregate, it's a lot of money.
And it's confusing. Okay. Yes. We will leave it there, but maybe Ohioans will notice something on their bill, you know, eventually. Maybe from this review of, especially the regulatory review, like they won't notice any.
They're not going to see their, you know, you're not going to see your utility bill cut in half or anything, right. But it'll probably be a couple of bucks.
Okay. All right. I want to move on to higher ed, the reality of federal changes and the new state higher ed law is hitting Ohio colleges and universities. Because Senate Bill 1 has gone into effect and they're having to deal with the ramifications of that. And then there's changes at the federal level regarding funding. Many universities are shutting down DEI offices, eliminating programs and majors. Megan, you wrote several stories in recent weeks related to higher education. So can we start with the University of Toledo? They're going to stop offering 9 undergraduate majors. Africana Studies, Asian Studies. Can you tell me about why the University of Toledo is deciding to cut these majors?
Yes. So it's all related to Ohio's new higher ed law that has been signed by Governor DeWine. It is taking effect at the end of June. And so we're in this like limbo right now where universities across the state are trying to figure out, like public universities that is, are trying to figure out how is this new higher ed bill or higher ed law in Ohio going to affect their universities. It relates to a slew of things such as DEI, faculty striking, and with the University of Toledo, it deals with low enrollment courses and programs. So basically, the law says that, you know, if you're not graduating X many students over the course of a handful of years consecutively, those programs will be cut or just taken. The majors will be taken out of it, and they'll just be some classes. And so that is what's happening with the University of Toledo. They have said that, hey, these programs have not graduated under the new law enough students. And so we are going to take away the chance for students to major in this program. Now, some of these classes will still exist at the University of Toledo, but they will just be like under a gen ed requirement.
Yeah, your article also listed Middle Eastern studies, Spanish, religion, philosophy, women and gender studies. So some classes will still exist in this, but the idea of majoring in Spanish at the University of Toledo, that's going away.
Correct. Yes. And so there has been some pushback. People are understandably not happy to hear that news, especially folks who are in those programs. Now, the university did say that if you are currently on track to graduate with this program, like that is, you will still have a chance to do that. But the University of Toledo has said that you cannot, starting this school year, 2025-2026, you cannot enroll as someone with this major.
And Senate Bill 1 included language that requires university to eliminate these degrees. So you said it was five degrees annually over a 3-year period? Is that the number?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. So you also wrote about Youngstown State University. They are taking the lead in trying to repeal parts of this recently passed higher education bill known as Senate Bill 1. They were trying to get it on the ballot, right? Like, is Youngstown's basically taking the lead on trying to get this on the ballot?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. So some of the faculty in their union are trying to get a referendum, which basically during this limbo between when the governor has signed a bill into law and before it goes into effect, there can be a referendum. And so the first step of that has been completed, of just getting collecting signatures. So they needed 1,000 signatures. They collected 4 times that and sent it recently to Secretary of State Frank LaRose to get the signatures approved, and also sent petition language for the referendum to Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost. And so now they're just waiting to hear back to see if the signatures and the summary have been approved. If those things get approved, then they can start collecting signatures to get this on the ballot for November. So it's quite the legal process.
Yeah, Shane?
And today is the deadline for the Attorney General to approve or disapprove of the petition language that they submitted to him.
Okay, so if he approves it today, then they can move forward and get the signatures. But if he says no, then...
Well, yeah, if he approves it, then it will go to the ballot board. Mm-hmm. I believe it still has to go through the ballot board just to make sure it's one issue, but that's usually happens pretty quickly. But then they're going to have a short timeline. They have to collect, what is it, like 250,000 signatures, something and like that, by the time this goes into effect.
Right. Yes.
So, and that, but there are certain groups that are saying that maybe putting this on the ballot to repeal it's not the way to go. They want to sue to remove parts of the law instead. So not everyone is in agreement.
Right. Well, that's the thing with this bill. Like it is so encompassing. There's lots to it. And so I could see some groups suing for parts against parts of the bill. But I think if they're trying to attack the whole law at once, the referendum would be the way to do it.
Hmm. You also wrote a story about Wilberforce, Ohio's only HBCU, and that school is worried. What did they tell you they're worried about?
Yes. So Wilberforce is Ohio's only public, historically black university in Ohio. And the folks there are worried about the chilling effect that this law could potentially have in the classrooms, even if the law doesn't say, like, you can't, doesn't outrightly say you can't talk about a certain topic, they're worried that it might cause professors to second guess or just question or just play it safe and be cautious for fear of potentially getting in trouble with the new law.
Hmm. So did they tell you that they were going to take any action related to the new law, or are they just going to just like see what happens?
It seems like seeing what happens. And when I talked to them a few weeks ago, Wilberforce had not come out and announced any changes to their university in regards to Senate Bill 1, which we're starting to see universities starting to trickle out with news releases and memos, such as University of Toledo with their changes. And so we still have not heard how that'll impact their university directly. Mm-hmm.
This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich, and we are talking with Megan Henry from the Ohio Capital Journal, Shane Stegmiller from Hannah News Service, and Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com. Shane, you wrote about a looming deadline that's approaching. It's been approaching for a long time, probably like 20 years. The Real ID deadline is this week. Tell us why people need a Real ID this week.
So the Real ID dates back to came out of the September 11th. 2001 attacks. It's kind of a heightened security measure to make sure that you're using like a legitimate identification. The main place people are going to run into this is if they're trying to travel by air. They'll need a Real ID starting this week to board a plane. If you're going into certain government buildings, you'll also need a Real ID. Military bases is probably one of the big places you will see that demanded.
And Ohio's, when you wrote your story, which wasn't yesterday, I don't know when, but Ohio's compliance rate was 56% at that time. Did the BMV add hours? Are they trying to get more people through? Or?
Yeah. So they said that they're doing things to try and process people a lot quicker. A lot more quickly. They expanded hours on Saturday. That's when a lot of people are off and have the time to go in at the deputy registrar's, where you can go in person, because it's a little more complicated of a process, because you have to bring more documents than just your regular driver's license. You have to have like your birth certificate. You have to have a certain identification with your current address.
And if you're a woman who changed her name, you have to have your marriage certificate.
Yes.
And it has to have a raised seal. And then you have to have two other pieces of documentation that are like bills that have your name on them, not just your husband's name. It's not easy for a woman who has changed her name. I will tell you that much.
Right. And when you do go to it, you don't get the card right away. It'll give you something that says you are Real ID compliant, but you have to wait for a week or two to get the actual ID in the mail.
Yeah, I'm glad I went through the process a few years ago when I had to renew my license and got it over with. But at the time, it was a pain.
And I'm not a married woman, so it wasn't as bad for me. But yeah. It was during COVID, so you know, the BMVs were already pretty packed, and then you had to wait longer just to do that.
Now, this has been 20 years in coming. So anyone who shows up at the airport on May 7th or May 8th and can't fly, they shouldn't be surprised, right, that they have the wrong ID.
No, they shouldn't. If you're going to be traveling soon, you definitely need to make sure you have all of that information, you know, have your real ID updated and that. And the Ohio BMV has a pretty good website where they list all the documents you need. You can find places where you can go to do it.
Now, if you have a passport, you can use that still, right?
I believe so, but...
I believe so. I think that is a document that if you go to get a real ID...
Yeah, yes. I do believe that's...
Yes. Whenever I did it at the time, my passport was expired. So that's my fault, because it is easier to get it if you have a passport. I will say that. But that's on me, you know. You know, nobody's perfect there.
I am curious if this might cause like some congestion, especially the first like couple of months or so, just as folks are, you know, who don't have a real ID or maybe getting stopped or, you know, have to go through.
Yeah, some people who only fly in the summer, maybe, and they show up at the airport and and they get stopped at TSA saying they can't get on the plane. Is that what's going to happen, basically? All right. So I don't know what Ohio's compliance rate being at 56%. I don't know how that compares to the rest of the country, or if that's like, are we doing a good job? Or
when I wrote the story a week or two ago, they told me that was about in line with the rest of the country.
Okay. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about a new poll about President Trump's approval rating here in Ohio. That's when the Reporter Roundtable continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides, the weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. With me this hour, Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Megan Henry, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, and Shane Stegmiller, a reporter for the Hanna News Service. So 100 days into the second Trump administration, and his support in Ohio is slipping a little bit. A poll from Bowling Green State University found that Trump's approval rating dropped 7% from a February poll, so it's down to 44%. He was slightly above 50% a few months ago. What does everyone make of this slight drop in support for Trump here in Ohio?
That seems to follow what the national polls have found. His support, though, still looks like higher than the national average, but he is underwater now in Ohio.
And that same poll showed that Vivek Ramaswamy was holding a wide lead in the 2026 Republican nomination for governor. Ramaswamy in this poll was the top choice at 64%. He was followed by Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel, who is not even actually running for governor, at 14%. And then Dave Yost, who is running for governor, at 13%. Heather Hill, who also has declared that she's running, at 4%. Jeremy, what do you make of Jim Tressel beating Dave Yost in this poll when he's not even in the race?
Not great for Dave Yost, obviously, given Yost has been in statewide office for coming up on, four terms now? Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's easier. It's like when you see polls for generic Democrats and Republicans, it's easy to say, oh, I'm going to support that person. But if Jim Tressel actually entered the race, mm-hmm. he would have to put forth policies that people might not like. So right now, everyone who doesn't like Vivek Ramaswamy can kind of put their hopes and dreams in Jim Tressel, who is not running and hasn't put forward like a campaign platform or a campaign at all. Mm-hmm. And so I think it kind of more reflects people, the anti-Ramaswamy crowd, who tends to be more supporters of Mike DeWine, that they see him as more electable. But at the same time, Tressel hasn't entered the race, and right now there's not much sign that he's going to. Mm-hmm. I think Ramaswamy has done a really good job so far of trying to come out and just shock and awe campaign out of the gate to try to seal up the nomination as quickly as possible. He got a Trump endorsement very early on, Later this week, it looks like he's going to get the state Republican Party primary endorsement, which opens up a whole bunch of additional options for him and benefits. And same with U.S. Senate with John Houston. And so he's really doing everything he can now to make sure to edge out Jim Tressel and keep him out of the race, and also sideline Dave Yost.
Megan, what do you think of Ramaswamy in this poll having such a commanding lead, 64%? I mean, that is significant.
Yes, that is. I'm not too surprised. As Jeremy was mentioning, I mean, he's gotten quite a few prominent endorsements. He's really put his name out there quite a bit. Obviously got a lot of attention when he was running for the Republican nominee for president. So not surprising. I think, too, with Jim Tressel, you know, he's very new to state office. It's been a couple months, but hasn't really done anything at this moment, like super, super noteworthy. So I think while it is interesting that he is above Dave Yost, I think I'm not surprised that Ramaswamy was so far in the lead.
And Shane, the same poll had polled Democrats as well, and it had former Ohio Department of Health Director Amy Acton, who is the only declared Democrat for governor. But in this poll, they also included some pretend opponents, as Jeremy said, as they tend to do. So this poll included former U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown and former U.S. Rep. Tim Ryan. And Brown led the Democratic field at 59%. Acton was at 20. Ryan was at 16. So what do you make of Sherrod Brown being so far ahead Acton, who's actually running?
It's not surprising. First of all, a lot of times in the early stages, name recognition plays a lot into it. And Sherrod Brown is still a very popular Democrat, especially among Democrats in Ohio. So I think a lot of Democrats would like to see him run. And they're probably not as familiar with what Acton stands for at this time, but she's slowly building the campaign, and there's not really a lot of other candidates. So a lot of it's coming down to hypotheticals.
And as an update, too, it's looking more and more like Tim Ryan is going to enter the governor's race.
Has he hinted?
Well, a close advisor to him told me on Friday that he's seriously considering running. And
oh, that's a yes, right? Almost.
And he hasn't formed a campaign committee or not, but he's ramped up his national TV appearances. Mm-hmm. He is now starting to accept in-person meetings as candidates for statewide office do, like with local Democratic parties around the state, and speaking appearances, that sort of thing. Sherrod Brown still, though, is in the catbird seat here. He can wait till late spring or even summer, maybe even fall, to say, okay, I'm going to run for this office. And then whoever's already running for that position, if there's anyone, will run for another office or make room for him, because he has that control. Now, the thing is, though, he hasn't made any sign that he will run for anything. He actually took apart his campaign committee and moved all the money to, you know, like a PAC. And he can, you know, if he decides to run for governor, he can use that PAC money to run for governor. But there's signs that he hasn't really made a decision yet. And so, but in the meantime, while we're waiting on Sherrod Brown to decide what to do, it looks like it's going to more and more like it's going to be a primary between Tim Ryan and Amy Acton.
Okay. And Megan, the with how much Ramaswamy is out there campaigning this early on, it makes it seem like Amy Acton's running a very quiet campaign, would you say?
Yes, I'd say that's accurate. Yeah, there hasn't really been much, you know, advertising. You know, I think she is doing some sort of statewide tour, I believe. But yeah, definitely a lot less notoriety so far with her campaign.
She's been doing fundraisers, though.
Fundraisers, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And those people have been holding fundraisers for her.
Which is in keeping. I mean, it's so early. It's so no one outside of that maybe that our political press corps and, you know, the group of political, you know, advisors are really looking at 2026 now. People are looking
Bowling
at tariffs.
Bowling Green is. They're doing
Bowling
polls.
Green is. Yeah. But it's not something that the Ohio Republican Party endorsements I talked about, those are usually made in in January, February of the election year. And now they've moved him all the way up to May before. So this has been an unusually accelerated race. So it's not unusual that Amy Acton's just raising money, because traditionally in a campaign cycle, this is the time that you're using to win over insiders and raise money, because if you air ads now, people aren't really going to be paying attention all that much. And that's the traditional thinking.
We're going to burn out over time because it's too long to be campaigning for the same office.
Right. Yeah. The whole, well, now you get all the money into you, and then you kind of turn a switch and then start spending the money, which usually happens in fall or early or in winter before the election.
This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. We're talking with Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, Shane Stegmiller from Hannah News Service, and Megan Henry from the Ohio Capital Journal. Megan, you wrote a piece about affordable housing. Advocates for affordable housing are lobbying lawmakers to change language that's included in the state budget. Can you tell me about what they want to see changed? What is in the budget that's a change for when it comes to affordable housing?
Yeah, so this all centers on the Ohio Housing Trust Fund, which I'll explain briefly. This was created back in 1991. Is funded by a portion of fees collected by county recorders, with half the fees staying with the county, the other half going back to the funds. When this requires that at least half of the funds be spent in non-urban areas. So that is the context of the Ohio Housing Trust Fund. And the House budget language would remove the requirement for county recorders to send the state the Department of Development money to reallocate the funds, which these housing advocates are saying that would make it less effective across the state when it comes to housing needs, when it comes to homeless shelters and being able to rehouse folks who are either experiencing homelessness or facing homelessness. So it's kind of unclear how this came about, but advocates are just asking the senators to strike this language from the budget and just keep the trust fund as is.
So the House said they wanted to eliminate the trust fund or change it.
They wanted to change it. Yes.
So the House wants to change it, but the Senate has the opportunity to change that.
Correct. Yes. As the Senate now, as the budget is now in the hands of the Senate, they can make changes to it. And so that is a change that they could make.
Now, the Ohio Housing Trust Fund is not something I had ever heard of until I read your story. Is it a well-known way that we have been? I mean, you said it was since 1991.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, honestly, same. It was a newer thing for me as well. I think it's been kind of like a well-oiled machine from what I've learned. And so the fact that they're trying to make changes to it just kind of came out of nowhere, since it has been in place for so long and has helped. Advocates said it's just helped, you know, thousands of people every year for folks who are, yeah, like I said, experiencing homelessness or running into issues with their home.
And Shane, you wrote a piece about Governor DeWine's new infant mortality initiative. Can you tell me about the plan that he has set forth?
So the governor went to Toledo to unveil this. And actually what it is it's not necessarily a new program, but it's taking a current program and expanding it to the state or the rest of the state. So it started down in Cincinnati area. Cradle Cincinnati is the name of the organization that was running it, and it's a model. It focuses on bringing parents, caregivers, healthcare professionals, community members, a bunch of different interested parties together to support moms and babies early. It's aimed at you know, trying to help them out during the most vulnerable times. And according to DeWine's office in that county, it reduced infant mortality, which is Hamilton County. They had an infant mortality rate in 2022 of 8.7 deaths for every 1,000 live births. And since then, the number's down to 5.5 deaths per 1,000 live births, which is about a 30% decrease. So they're expanding it to the Toledo area, Cleveland area, Columbus area, and finding organizations or hospitals to kind of partner and kind of take the lead on expanding it.
So using Cincinnati and Hamilton County as a model, because they're also bringing in Franklin County has what's called Celebrate One, and that was selected to be a part of this. So kind of like having Franklin County model a few things off of Hamilton County.
Right. And then the state will provide grant money to kind of help seed it and get it going.
Mm. And at this the same event, DeWine also touted his proposal for working families to get a tax cut of up to $1,000 for each child under the age of 7. But I thought that tax cut, did that get removed from the budget, the House?
It got removed, but the Senate could put it back in. And not only the Senate then, you know, just the way the budget process works. It's the House passes the budget, the Senate passes their version of the budget, and then there's a six-member conference committee that comes down and hammers out behind closed doors a final budget. Mm-hmm. So either the Senate or this conference committee could easily put that back in if they wanted to.
And so, so DeWine bringing this up was basically like him saying, remember that proposal I had, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Don't forget me.
This is another one of those areas of the budget that he's been very vocal on. Anytime he talks to reporters, he brings this up a lot of times.
All right. So we have less than a minute left. What's everyone going to be covering this week? What are you looking for happening this week?
Well, obviously, we have the primary election, and we'll see what comes out of that.
You'll write about issue two. Yes.
Issue two, of course. Then, as we were talking about before the show, there's going to be a number of legislative hearings, you know, maybe not at something coming out, but lawmakers are going to be back to work after a couple of week break.
Megan, what will you be covering?
Yeah, just a smattering of bills and committees. And later today, I'm actually going to an oil, land and gas oil commission meeting to where they're most likely be voting on parcels to frack in state lands.
Okay. And Shane, what are you going to be working on?
So I'm also watching issue two. I'm also going to be watching later today, see if the referendum is able to move forward on Senate Bill 1. And then there's a ton of, we've been talking about the budget. The Senate's going through their process right now. So they're bringing in all the different agencies and having them testify and explain to us why we should fund you for this next biennium.
All right. Well, that has been the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. Thank you, Shane Stegmiller from Hanna News Service. Thank you, Shane.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
And thank you, Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Thank you, Megan.
Always good to be here.
And thank you, Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, and a shout out to my 2-year-old daughter, Louisa.
Hi, Louisa. And thank you for listening today on the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.